Hi everyone, welcome to History of Asia. My name is still Christoph. Thanks for joining me. It's been a while, so let's get going. Last time, we saw how the British and the French carved up the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, which led to the creation of the Middle East as we know it, with Syria and Iraq, among others, emerging as distinct countries. We've seen why Europeans share some responsibility for the exclusionary politics that have come to typify these nations, but we ended by drawing attention to the inescapable fact that the mandates, all in all, didn't really last that long. The Ottoman sultans, by contrast, had ruled that region for centuries on end, so it's not crazy to think that their reign has had some long-term impact as well. I will take two episodes to cover the Ottoman period. In this one, I will focus on the empire's dying days, when it was casually dismissed as the sick man of Europe. What happened in Ottoman lands during the long 19th century goes a long way explaining the tensions that would plague Syria and Iraq to this day, I think. The dramatic changes of that era mostly came about as a result of the Ottoman reaction to European pressures. The first part of the episode, I will spend explaining, in brief, why these pressures mounted up. Then, I will discuss how the Ottomans decided to react and how that changed the relationship between the respective groups that inhabited their empire. So, how and why did the once mighty Ottoman Empire start to decline? Well, first of all, decline is in the eye of the beholder, but I think that almost all scholars agree that by the 19th century, almost all parameters had moved into the negative. Its territory was shrinking, its trade position worsening, the treasury was almost empty, and even its cultural influence was waning quickly. Start with the actual size of the empire. At its height, it stretched from Algeria over Central Europe to Ukraine and Eastern Arabia. Many of these lands were rich and populous, but just as important was the strategic position. The Ottomans controlled practically all the trade routes between Europe and the Orient. Consequently, they could make their Christian enemies pay through the nose for the spices and Indian wares that were in such high demand back in Europe. Constantinople fell to the Turks in 1453. Just a few decades later, Columbus undertook his famous voyage to America. That was not a coincidence. Nor was the fact that he refused to admit that he didn't actually find a new pathway to India. It's also not by accident that the Portuguese then traveled ever further around Africa. They all wanted to undermine the Ottomans' control over trade with the Orient. In the end, they succeeded. That was of course a disaster in and of itself, but it led to more trouble down the line. After India became British, it was deindustrialized. Indian cotton would then henceforth be shipped directly to Britain, where it was processed mechanically. The Ottoman fiber industry had no way to compete with that. Now, industry is one thing, but the Ottoman economy, like most others, was predominantly an agrarian one, and it had long held three fantastic bread baskets, namely Egypt, Southeastern Europe, and Mesopotamia. However, we already saw in an earlier episode how the Egyptian governor, Mehmet Ali, turned on the Sultan and became independent. And in Eastern Europe, the Ottomans would lose control too, often after separatist uprisings supported by Western European nations, like in Greece for instance. As a result, the economic foundations of the empire came to rest squarely on Mesopotamia. It was well understood that if the land between the two rivers were to fall as well, that might prove fatal. And that seemed all too likely. In what is now Iraq, the pashas of Basra, Mosul, and Baghdad had been autonomous for a long time, and the Europeans could freely access southern Iraq by sea, if they so wanted. The Ottoman navy was no match for the British one, say. It became more and more clear that if the Europeans set their minds to it that they wanted to take Mesopotamia, then the Ottomans would not be able to stop them, especially since they always had to keep their focus on the north. But the biggest military threat of all came from the Russians, who were very imperialist at this time. And that was still not even the worst part. The most dangerous threat came from within. The The rising powers of Europe had all become solid nation-states, in full control of their territory, able to raise troops and taxes in unprecedented numbers. The Ottoman Empire, by contrast, was still a patchwork of ethnicities and religions, as it had ever been. This had not always been a problem. In fact, it had enabled the government to practice divide and rule. But in a time of rising nationalism, this had the potential to become very explosive indeed, especially as the Europeans were not above exploiting these divisions. Under the guise of protecting Christians, the Russians and the French interfered ever more brazenly in the Ottoman affairs. In reality, these minorities didn't always have it all that bad. They enjoyed protection and were allowed to be governed by their own representatives, according to their own customs. But in other ways, their fate rendered them second-class citizens. So some might have hoped that European protection could help improve their lot. The most glaring way in which some of them benefited was through so-called capitulations. Simply put, the Sultan would grant citizens of friendly nations the right to trade within his borders, without them running the risk of confiscation or prosecution under local law. It's important to stress that didn't mean that the Ottomans capitulated to foreign pressure, as the word may seem to imply. It also had some upsides, and to the extent that there were victims, it was Muslim merchants, who were not highly regarded anyway. The Sultan originally used these capitulations as a diplomatic tool, for instance favoring his ally France over his traditional enemies, the Habsburgs. But as his power declined, he could no longer grant these rights at his own discretion. If he gave some new privilege to one European nation, others effectively forced him to grant the same to them. By the way, most favored nation clauses are still an important part of international trade agreements. But in this case, the Sultan effectively disadvantaged his own subjects relative to European competitors, except those who worked closely with the Europeans, because they could get these privileges too in that case. These practices fatally eroded the Ottoman tax base and could shift subjects' loyalties from the Sultan to the foreign partners. Quite often, locals, who became partners of European merchants, were again religious minorities. Not a recipe for warm relations with their Muslim neighbors, I imagine. I may have forgotten some other problems, but I think you can tell why many Ottoman subjects would have felt that their society was in decline. Now, in an earlier episode, we saw that whenever people notice this, they can react in two general ways. Simply put, they can either look forward or backward. The Wahhabis of Arabia declared that all the problems facing the Muslim world were in fact punishments from Allah, because Muslims had strayed from the proper path, none more so in their eyes than the Ottomans. The solution that the Wahhabis proposed was to return to how things supposedly were in the days of the Prophet Muhammad. As we've also seen before, the Egyptians took the opposite approach. They concluded that if the Europeans were pulling ahead, that must mean they had the right idea. And so they reckoned, if you want to catch up with them, you have to become like them. The result was quite impressive, but only in the short term. Emulating foreign examples is harder to pull off than it may sound. A modern state presupposes, among other things, a uniform, efficient tax system and a disciplined army under central command. But if that came about, it would not be to everyone's advantage. Like, for instance, the leaders of religious charities who hoarded wealth that was exempt from taxes. Or take tribal leaders who could order their men to fight or choose not to. Or take the provincial elites, like the pashas of what is now Iraq, who had become practically autonomous. They were not going to cooperate with a policy of renewed centralization. But the critical obstacle to reform were the military leaders, and especially the janissaries. They had once been at the cutting edge of military innovation, a standing army of highly trained foot soldiers brandishing firearms. They had once been the most formidable fighting force in all of Europe. But over the centuries, their training had slackened, and they had evolved into a parasitic Praetorian guard, basically, no longer capable of humbling foreign armies, but well capable of deposing or blackmailing a sultan who would get uppity. These janissaries had already snuffed out an early attempt at modernization in the early 1800s. with the consent of anti-reformist ulama and provincial leaders, they put a new sultan on the throne, who in return allowed the land rights of nobles to become hereditary, undermining the power of the central state even more. It would turn out, however, that this had merely been a tactical retreat on the part of the new sultan, because in 1826 he informed the Janissaries that he had plans of creating a modern army himself, knowing full well that they would never allow that. It would totally undermine their unique position. Just like he had anticipated, the Janissaries marched on his palace, where they walked right into a trap. Thousands were mowed down by artillery fire. Those that survived this were captured and beheaded. Perhaps you'll remember that the Egyptian governor Mehmet Ali had played a very similar trick on the Mamluks, lured them into the citadel of Cairo, where he had them trapped and shot. I don't know whether this may have been an inspiration for the elimination of the Janissaries, but the similarity is anyway striking. And perhaps such a ruse was the only way in which the Sultan could hope to overpower his overbearing bodyguards. Once the Janissaries within the capital had been dealt with, he was free to act against the rest. Just like the Mamluks were tracked down and killed all over Egypt after Mehmet Ali's ambush in Cairo, the Janissaries' downfall also reversed the fortunes of the ulama and the pashas. The central government reasserted its authority in places that had become autonomous, like in Syria and Iraq. The religious foundations were absorbed into a centrally controlled holding, a precursor to the degenerate Ministry of Religious Affairs in Turkey, some would say. The old system of Janissaries and feudal troops was mothballed, and in its place, finally, a modern army was formed. Less for the Ottomans, this takes time. And so they were not at all ready for a big confrontation, for instance, with the Egyptian army, which had been modernized a while back. The Egyptians seized the opportunity and defeated their old overlords. The Ottomans were only saved because the Europeans, and perhaps most of all the Russians, preferred them over the more effective Egyptians. Everyone in the Ottoman government could now see the writing on the wall. They were one step away from colonization, and there was only one way to avoid it. They had to become a modern state themselves, and quickly. The Europeans were moving ever faster ahead, and there was still a lot of catching up to do. In many places, infrastructure was still no better than in the Middle Ages, and the nomadic tribes remained notoriously hard to control, let alone tax and draft. Very few people in the empire were able to read or write, let alone master the technical innovations that would make all the difference in this brave new world that was unfolding. And so the Ottomans helped themselves to some strong medicine. In 1839, they announced a famous modernization program that would become known as Tanzimat. More drastic reforms would follow. It would be declared that all subjects would enjoy equal rights and obligations henceforth, regardless of their religion. This meant, among other things, that the non-believers' tax would be abolished, but also that minorities and Muslims alike could be conscripted. This was necessary to raise more taxes, create a strong modern army, and a firmer connection between subject and state. Schooling was taken out of the hands of the ulama. Instead, European-style secular schools were set up, especially, and this will become important later on, for training army officers, because creating a modern army would be top priority. These were drastic measures, no matter how you frame it, but some cures have the capacity to kill you, especially if the body's immune system fights it. Within the empire, there were still powerful actors who would need some strong convincing if they were ever going to cooperate with these plans. Take, for instance, the nomadic tribes that were an intricate part of the landscape in the Middle East. They were notoriously hard to control and proud of that. Their chiefs had no desire to hand their customary rights as leaders of the community to some state official. But if the stick wouldn't work, then perhaps the carrot might. Partly to entice the chiefs to cooperate, the Ottomans changed the system of land ownership. In an agricultural empire, land was the most precious commodity of all. But ownership had always been stratified and largely determined by custom. Even before the Ottomans came to these lands, warriors had been given land rights as payment for their service, while other land had been placed under Islamic foundations. But both these systems were effectively abolished now. People could now claim official property titles. But the system to do so was very complex, and many were suspicious of the government's intentions. For whatever property is registered can also be taxed, of course. Tribesmen did not place their trust in the government anyway. Instead, they counted on their sheikh. The state was abstract and distant, while the chief was familiar and close. This time, however, their confidence would often prove misplaced. Tribal leaders personally acquired the deeds to land that was used by the entire community. It must no doubt have looked natural to register formerly common lands under the name of the community's leader, but over time this would drastically change the relationship, which would only become clearer as sheikhs eventually became politicians in the 20th century. As Yitzhak Nakash so nicely put it, they would develop a class consciousness, and I think that process starts here. So this seemingly technical, almost boring measure in effect changed how some chiefs and other notables viewed the state, no longer as a threat to their independence, but as a guarantor of their property. But it wasn't just the sheikhs who would take advantage of these land reforms. Basically everyone who was influential or wealthy enough, everyone who had the network and the know-how, could acquire titles to lands, even to lands to which they had no connection whatsoever, like bureaucrats and rich merchants. This form of ownership also created incentives for innovation. It was conditional upon the owner's ability to pay the land tax, so the new owners had to make sure that their plots made enough money to do so, and preferably a little extra to make it worth their while. They had to think hard about how to make their land productive. The answer was, often, to produce cash crops. Common land had earlier served the needs of the local community. Now, the many people who ended up with no property at all had to work it for the benefit of their owner, who sold the produce for his own profit. This often meant that tribesmen were forced to settle and become tenants of their former chief. As a result of all this, the interests of the landowners and the state became more aligned. However, this didn't always work, and nowhere was the failure more glaring than in the Kurdish area. Previously, the Kurdish emirs had an uneasy relationship with the Ottoman state, but they were left undisturbed, in general, and even received recognition and support. The Sultan was not inclined to try to administer their wild lands anyway, and the emirs were useful to him because they could mediate between the government and the local tribes, who respected them. Just like the nobles in towns like in Syria, for instance. The Kurdish chiefs were even happy at times to supply troops to the Sultan to help him break resistance to direct rule in other corners of the empire. However, this marriage of convenience would come to an end when the Ottomans' humiliating defeats, notably against the Egyptians, laid bare their military weakness. This tempted the Kurdish emirs to go their own way. In turn, the Ottomans began to see them as a stinging obstacle to modernization. So the emirs stopped cooperating and lost their recognition. The mutual respect gave way to confrontation, and the result proved disastrous for both parties. The Sultan would find that without intermediaries, he had great trouble getting anything done in the Kurdish mountains. Coercive control was unfeasible. Punitive expeditions did not help either. The emirs, for their part, found that by losing their recognition and ability to mediate, they also lost some of their legitimacy. And finally, it became clear to what extent the old understanding had put a brake on tribal conflicts. The region fell into anarchy and became a base for gangs of robbers. So the Sultan ultimately swallowed his pride and again sought to co-opt the Kurdish chieftains. Where it did succeed, the new system had unexpected and long-lasting side effects. According to Yitzhak Nakash, it even explains to a large degree why Iraq is in majority Shiite. This is far from inevitable, because as we've seen in the series on Iran, for centuries on end, the Ottomans were at loggerheads with the Iran of the Safavids, and that rivalry would also have a religious dimension, as the Safavids were radical Shiites. Sunnis were prosecuted in Iran, while the Ottomans went after their own Shiites, rendering both empires more religiously homogeneous. There still remained the fact, however, that the Shiites' most important shrine cities, Najaf and Karbala, were in Ottoman territory. So when in the 1700s the Persian general Nadir Shah tried to end the dominance of Shiism in Iran, many Shiite scholars fled to these shrine cities in Iraq. As a result, by the end of the 18th century, these towns had become major centers of Shiite learning. When the Ottomans subsequently tried to settle nomadic tribes in this area, they often did so in and around these cities for entirely practical reasons, first and foremost, the presence of water. The tribes then shed some of their tribal identity, as had been one of the objectives of the whole reform, but as farmers, they now had to establish ties with local merchants, who they intended to sell their produce to. And you can no doubt hear it coming from afar, this link would be provided by converting to Shiism under the auspices of the numerous Shiite ulama who had settled there in preceding decades. Now, if this thesis were correct, that would mean that Iraq only became majority Shiite during the 1800s. The Ottomans may not have liked this new sectarian identity, but I suppose they preferred it to the troublesome tribal identity that it replaced. Besides, Iran now had another dynasty, which didn't trouble the Ottomans as much as the Safavids had once done. Perhaps the most interesting part of this is that just like tribalism didn't dissolve in the state but rather fused with it, so too tribalism merged with Shiite beliefs. And this led to a variety of Shiism that was quite distinct from the one predominant in Iran. Yitzhak Nakash gives some remarkable examples. You will remember the Muharram celebrations that feature reenactments of Imam Hussein's doomed last struggle. Well, Iraqi Shiites apparently focus on Hussein's martial prowess and his sense of honor, while in Iran, by contrast, it was all about lamentation and martyrdom. The question then becomes, of course, just how important these distinctions can become politically. When Khomeini called upon Shiites to revolt, Saddam Hussein apparently feared that Iraqi Shiites would indeed turn on him, which explains partly why he chose to invade Iran. Most of his Shiite soldiers did remain loyal to Iraq, however, it would turn out. Although it's debatable whether that was because of their genuine loyalty or because their Sunni officers just had zero tolerance for dissent. I would suggest the latter because, as you will recall, at the end of the Gulf War, President Bush expressed the hopes that they might revolt after all, and they did. This would seem to suggest that Iran didn't have so much influence on Iraqi Shiites after all, perhaps because of the distinct form of Shiism that they followed. Perhaps influenced by books such as that of Yitzhak Nakash, American analysts apparently concluded that if Saddam were to be brought down, the power vacuum wouldn't be filled by Iran. That proved to be another miscalculation, however. Peter Galbraith pointed out, in his book, that this was foreseeable since the main Shiite parties had been set up in Iran, while the most prominent Shiite cleric in Iraq, al-Sistani, is also of Iranian descent. Galbraith likes to mock American officials for not having done their homework, basically. But if they had read the highly praised analysis of Nakash, that would only have reinforced their idea that Iranian influence would remain limited. There is not necessarily anything wrong with the analysis, I don't think, but attitudes change. These days, Iraqis increasingly blame Iran for their troubles, and in Qom, al-Sistani is seen more as a rival than an ally. He is also opposed Khomeini's guardianship of the jurist doctrine. This all shows, I think, just how careful we should be when making predictions based on history. Now, maybe part of the reason why the mass conversions to Shiism would be sort of tolerated was that the government was trying to shed its Muslim image anyway. They sought to end religious discrimination, the Ottomans. But even though total equality never materialized, the idea alone was enough to get Muslims up in arms. Instead of going along with the imitation of Europe, many put a renewed emphasis on their faith. That was perhaps inevitable. For most of its history, the Ottoman Empire had ruled massive groups of Christians. They may even have constituted a majority at times. With this in mind, they knew better than to antagonize non-Muslims. But eventually, they had to give up their European territories, and what remained was overwhelmingly Islamic. It therefore became less vital for them to take Christian feelings into account. And there were other frustrations. Modernization, it turned out, cost a lot of money. Tax reform was unpopular, all the more so because the capital remained largely exempt. The authorities apparently didn't want to take the risk that unrest might break out on their own doorstep, but those who lived in the provinces naturally found this unfair, especially since all this investment didn't bring the hoped-for result, catching up with Europe. Although European countries had been happy to lend it money, the Ottoman state was unable to pay them back, and in 1875 it defaulted on its debt. Just a year later, the Tanzimat itself was for all intents and purposes considered bankrupt, and it was ended. Many people had come to the conclusion that the drugs simply weren't working. I found the following quote from an Ottoman conservative in Bailey's The Birth of the Modern World. I think it's very telling. Here it is, quote, "The fallacy that everything European can be imitated here has become a political tradition. For example, by simultaneously introducing Russian uniforms, Belgian rifles, Turkish headgear, Hungarian saddles, English swords, and French drill, we have created an army that is a grotesque parody of Europe," unquote. Cultural appropriation, anyone? By the way, this was by no means unique to the Ottoman Empire. All over the globe, people in the 1800s started taking on clothes, manners, and other symbols that were unmistakably European in origin. From Japanese politicians over Maori chiefs to representatives of former slaves in Saint-Domingue. Rest assured that these people didn't try to make fun of Western culture. In fact, even suggesting that they dressed up as Westerners would be an unfair insult in my mind. Because on what ground could you tell another person what not to wear, right? Likewise, if white-skinned teenagers today wear dreadlocks and listen to Bob Marley, you shouldn't imagine that they are trying to mock Jamaican culture. On the contrary, they are expressing their admiration. So let me ask you this deep, deep question. Can't we all just get along? Well, the backlash can come from both sides, can't it? Today, white supremacists claim that white-skinned rappers are in fact betraying their own race, in air quotes. And in the late 1800s, many Ottoman subjects had had enough of what they saw as westernization. The authoritarian Sultan Abdulhamid II would capitalize on the aggrieved feelings of Muslims and make the most of his official role as caliph. He also didn't think that parliaments and constitutions were appropriate for his people, so he put a stop to that too, just a few years after they had come into being. This, however, irritated those young officers who had been fed secular and enlightened ideas in those military schools that had been set up in recent decades. Told you this was going to be important, right? So in 1908, these officers led a coup known as the Young Turk Revolt. They'd forced the Sultan to revert to the constitutional system of the late Tanzimat. But that didn't mean that nothing had changed in the meantime. As their name implies, the Young Turks were no fan of the old multi-ethnic empire. One reason for starting the Tanzimat reforms in the first place had been the fear that nationalism might spread from Europe, which would lay wide open the ethnic fault lines within the empire. Ethnic identities had always been vague and fluid in the Ottoman lands. The Sultan himself was exemplary of that, as he was the product of generations of inter-ethnic mixing. The Sultan's harems had been full of Christian women, after all. The answer had been to promote a non-ethnic Ottoman nationalism, primarily through modern education. But this experiment, ironically, generated the ultimate gravediggers of the multi-ethnic empire, namely the Young Turks. Once they took power, they intended to give the country a new foundation, no longer multi-ethnic, but Turkish. This inevitably led to friction with the other ethnic groups, like the Arabs. The British could take advantage of this to start the Arab Revolt, although most Arabs, it seems, would remain loyal to their empire. As did most Kurds, by the way. And that's even after the government abandoned its multi-ethnic outlook and became openly pro-Turkish. So at least when it comes to the Muslim part of the empire, the Ottoman sphere of nationalism turned out to have been a bit excessive, and the Christian parts would be lost anyway. So when it comes to nationalism, taking this cure, or this vaccine if you will, maybe that wasn't the best choice. In hindsight, of course. I'd like to end the episode by talking a bit more about how the specific way in which Iraqi Shiism took hold has helped to bring about the long-lasting marginalization of these Shiites. First of all, there is the fact that they were concentrated around shrine cities that were more tied to next-door Iran than to Baghdad, and this would contribute to their political isolation, and it ensured that Shiites and Sunnis would rarely mingle. The fact that many, if not most, inhabitants were Iranian students and immigrants, that would provide the Iraqi government with a pretext to expel agitating Shiites on the grounds that they were all illegal aliens. How convenient. One reason why the clerics had gained such influence in these shrine cities was that they received generous funding from the East, which they could then use to build a local patronage network. But this source would dry up once that Reza Khan, the Shah of Iran, had decided that the money must now stay in Iran. There, clerical power depended on close ties with the bazaar, bonds that had organically grown over time, often through common opposition to an overreaching state. Recall the tobacco protest, for instance. We talked about this in the last series. Their counterparts in Iraq, however, shared no such common tradition. The clerics there only start to oppose British colonialism in the 20s, and unsuccessfully at that, which meant that it would weaken their influence instead of strengthening it. As for the Shiite merchants, as late as the 1940s, the markets of the big trading centers in Baghdad and Basra were still dominated by Jews. That only changed with the founding of Israel, because Arabs then took their anger out on the local Jewish community, communities that had lived by the rivers of Babylon since biblical times, by the way, but now they all felt forced to go back to Zion. The vacuum that they left behind was mostly filled by Shiites, but these were newcomers, and so they didn't have a bond with Shiite clerics that was comparable to that of their counterparts in Iran, where that had grown over the ages. Then there was the fact that the two main shrine cities competed with each other for devotees and gifts, and for other business too. One that triggers my imagination is the funeral industry. You hear that right? Countless Shiites wanted to be buried close to Ali or Hussein, so that they would sit in the first row when the end days arrived. Apparently, there was a genuine cluster of industries built around these burials, like grave diggers, or people selling food to the visitors. It was like Silicon Valley for funerals, you might say. So a lot of income depended on this. You have to imagine waiting lines of thousands upon thousands of coffins, and this under the desert sun. The sight of it must have been apocalyptic, and the smell even more so, I suppose. For visitors, it would have been impossible to forget this experience, and you could count on it that they would spread word about what they had witnessed. And this would in turn contribute to the prestige of the city in question, and hence bring it more pilgrims, more gifts, and more business. So given the stakes, you can imagine that there was a very real rivalry between these cities in every sense. As Nakash relates, if a rumor would spread that a miracle had occurred in Karbala, you could be sure of it that soon you'd hear of an even greater wonder that had happened in Najaf, and vice versa. It's rather funny, but for Shiites, it had the sorry consequence that it would make it difficult for these power centers to cooperate with one another. And then there was the fact that so much of these cities' power was centered around religion. A big reason why Iraq Shiites had little political impact until recently was that they were excluded from important government positions. At first, their lack of governing experience could explain this to some extent, but over time, more and more Shiites would enroll in the new state schools, and so they would acquire the necessary education. But tribal connections determined who got hired, and as you sometimes hear, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Since Shiites didn't usually have access to Sunni networks, they would still be excluded. This naturally frustrated their best and brightest, but had they teamed up with the Shiite clerics and tribesmen, then they would have been hard to ignore. But because they were the product of their secular education, such an alliance would never materialize. Instead of putting their weight behind Shiite politicians, the tribes and clerics tended to boycott the political process altogether. And while sectarian solidarity would be undermined in multiple ways, cunning Sunni politicians managed to present themselves as their allies. Saddam, for instance, claimed to be a descendant of Ali himself. His propagation of tribal virtues may also have been meant to please the tribesmen, regardless of their sect. At some point, a Shiite prime minister was even put in place. But when he failed to quell protests among Shiite communities, he was then forced to resign again. So such figures could do little for the community that they came from, even if they wanted to. The same could be said of the Kurds who occasionally climbed to high positions. The officer who overthrew the Iraqi monarchy, for instance, Qasem, was himself partly Kurdish. But that didn't make him open to Kurdish demands for autonomy. His government would clash with Kurdish emirs, who therefore switched their allegiance to his political rivals, the Ba'ath. And then this history would repeat itself. As relations with Baghdad hardened further, more and more Kurds would start to dream of an independent state. But like the Shiites, the Kurds were often divided, in their case between tribal alliances, like Talabani versus Barzani. And this can partly be traced down to the fact that the Kurdish region was mostly excluded from the reforms of the era that we just covered, so that different emirs would hold sway in different regions, emirs that were by default envious and distrustful of each other. The division of the Shiites and the Kurds would enable the continued reign of the Sunni minority for a long time, a minority that had in a way inherited Iraq from the Ottomans, and that was mostly true of the Syrian region as well. So I think we may conclude that the tensions between the ethnic and sectarian groups in these lands are at least partly rooted in the late Ottoman period. But of course, the Turks had been there for centuries before, and events in that long period also had a lasting impact. More on that next time. Thank you for listening, and special thanks for the nice people who sent me encouraging messages over email or in the episode comments. It means a lot to me to hear that you appreciate what I try to do here, so a big hug for all of you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.